Two scriptures I'd like to highlight, and I want to make sure that I give ample time to explain them, but not as much as could be said either about the Gospel of John or the Gospel of Matthew. John 6, starting in verse 33. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. So they said, from now on, give us this bread. Then Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty. And then a reading from Matthew's gospel. Matthew reminds us that Jesus is the king. Matthew 11, verses 28, 29, and 30. Jesus says, come to me, all you are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. And so we worship this evening with proclamation of the word, with a lighting of candles to proclaim that Christ is the light, and you are the light of the world, so says Jesus in Matthew chapter 5. We come together to sing songs, and songs are been sung since the beginning of time. The first song that was actually recorded was Adam's song when he looked at his wife Eve, and it's either a poem or a song, and all the way to the end where the Bible ends in a garden, there's the singing of songs. So we sing these songs and we light these candles to remember the celebration of Christ coming. And I want to focus particularly on two things, that Jesus is our life. And in this passage we read in John, he makes a promise that those who believe in him will never be thirsty and never be hungry if we partake of Christ. And that can only be made by somebody that's eternal. For only someone that was outside of history can come into history and live the perfect life and make atonement for our sin on the cross, but then be raised to life. So when Jesus is our life, he gives us life outside of ourself. He proclaims to us that he is our life and he is also our rest. Where Matthew says, quoting Jesus, come to me, all you are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. When Jesus says, I'm the bread of life, he who comes to me will never be hungry. Jesus says, I am the source of your life, both now and forevermore. And Matthew 11, 28, where Jesus says for us to come and he'll give us rest, he's promising something beyond physical rest. But my guess is you probably need some physical rest. These are busy times for us. Busy in families and busy in celebrations and busy in travel. But the kind of rest that Jesus is talking from are primarily two things. Rest from our labor and rest from the law. Many years ago, I went to see a counselor because I was dealing with issues of stress. And I met with Pablo Polachek up the street at Gordon Conwell, a very insightful man. And I was worried about many things. Are you ever worried about many things? More things than you can store in your head. And you go to sleep and you're just about ready to go to sleep. And what happens is you start thinking about all the things that are causing you stress. And so he gave me some very, very helpful coaching. He said, two times a day, God has built into the means of creation a reminder in the physical what Jesus does for us in the spiritual. And I asked him, what did he mean by that? He said, unless you eat food, you will die. So every single day, you have to take in some kind of nourishment, or over a certain period of time, if you take nothing in from the outside, you will die. You will not have any life. And he also said, every single day, you have to rest. You have to sleep. Short term, you become more nervous. Longer term, your faculties start to fade. Longer term, your internal organs will no longer function. You must rest to have life. And Jesus is the master of taking ordinary things and making extraordinary promises. He's this master teacher, and he was teaching the people along the wayside. For people of his day, bread was the foundation of every meal. It was the staple of life. It was sometimes all they had. And sometimes they missed meals, and sometimes they had to go more than a day or two. No bread, no satisfaction for their hunger. No bread, no life. No bread, no energy. For you see, bread was the staff of life. And the typical person in Jesus' day is trying to get their mind around when Jesus says that the kind of bread that he gives, and he's talking about salvation, he's talking about that space inside of you that needs to be filled with something from the outside. For you see, the gospel is not absurd. The gospel says that we have an internal problem and that we need external help. In the passage in John, the Gospel of John has been speaking all the way along about Jesus being the light and Jesus being the life. And there is no life without light. And so when Jesus says that the bread that he's going to give them is much deeper than what they can imagine, they had a hard time getting their mind around it. And sometimes might you and I. But isn't it interesting, if I were to say to you, we're going to take away all of your money, I mean, you're going to have no money. You're not going to have a quarter. You're not going to have anything in your change draw at home. There's nothing in your car. There's no piggy bank. There's no jar. There's no hidden stash of cash. You have nothing. And isn't it interesting that we often talk about money like bread, don't we? Or we talk about money like food. We got to bring home the bacon, or we want some of that green cabbage, or do you have the dough? So as important as money was to us, so when Jesus said, I'm going to give you a perpetual supply of bread, if you believe and trust upon me, these people were utterly amazed. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. And I will feed your soul and satisfy your life, talking about salvation, but also the deep longings of all of humanity. For you see, generations have sung songs to try to fill that inner space within their soul. And about every 20 years, there's a song that's sung. Peggy Lee, is that all there is? Her house burns down. And she watched her whole world go up in flames, and this is the 50s and the 60s. And she says, is that all there is? And moving into the 70s, the 80s, the Rolling Stones, I can't get no satisfaction as hard as I try. And then in the 80s and the 90s, Kansas, Dust in the Wind. We're only just dust in the wind, just a drop of water in an endless sea. And all we do crumbles on the ground, yet we refuse to see. And then Nirvana and Kurt Cobain and his suicide nihilism, you know you're right. And then moving into the 2000s, Amy Winehouse, she is singing a song of the rejection of the love of her life. When we went through the Gospel of John, we talked about the Asian culture, and Grace Lee confirmed this. They said, it's like we have a second stomach, and we never feel full until we get our share of rice. So when Jesus is talking about bread, and he's talking about eternity, he's talking about that deep yearning within our soul for something that answers the deepest questions of life, of where have we come from, who are we, why are we here, where are we going, what is right, what is real, and how do we know? And Jesus said, I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. He makes this wonderful promise. He comes from the outside of this world. He recognizes we have an internal need, and then he is willing to take our place and die on a cross. And he gives us life beyond. And he says what we hunger and thirst for will not be denied. He's a great Savior. He's a great God. He's the greatest giver. And Jesus is the reason for this season. He gives us what we need the most. He came to us because we could not come to him. Now in Matthew's gospel, and somehow I'm losing my voice right now. In Matthew's gospel, he invites people who are weary and burdened, and he gives them rest. Now there's two primary reasons why these people are weary. First was their labor of everyday life, and second of all was the law. Their labor was so tough because most of it revolved around having to do physical work. They may have had some pulleys and some levers and some wheels and possibly a horse or a mule. But day in and day out, if they didn't labor, they wouldn't have the necessities of life. And you might say, well, I don't have to do heavy labor. I'm in a white-collar job. Well, how about stress in your life? How about aging the body? It's harder to do things that you used to do easily. Or how about perfectionism? Charles Stanley said the American culture is based on appearance, performance, and status. What Stanley says is that's an anti-grace state. Life was so hard. With famine and disease and hard work, the paganism of Rome, the immorality, the pestilence, no health plans. And then Jesus comes as a king with a different kind of kingdom and said, I will be your strength. I will be the one who will carry your burdens. I will be the one who will stick closer than a brother. You ever feel burdened? What do you do with your burdens? You have any burdens from work or children, from the future, from home projects to maintenance schedules, to your snow blower breaking down, to college payments for your kids, or fear of you're not going to have enough, or retirement? And yet, Jesus makes this statement that goes all the way through the end of time. If you are laboring in areas, he says, I want to take that from you. When he comes into your life, he will begin to carry that burden for you so you do not have to carry it yourself. That's good news, brothers and sisters. And then the last thing that Jesus does, he promises us to take away the burden of the law. And so in the context in Matthew, there's all these debates going on between the Pharisees, and the common people never felt like they had done enough because there were the Ten Commandments, there were ceremonial and cultural and religious laws surrounding worship. They added 613 new laws to protect the Ten Commandments, and then they had the Talmud and the Mishnah, and then they needed a local rabbi to interpret whether they were breaking the law. If not, they had a fear of being rejected by God. So profound and so in-depth was it that you actually, you had chicken and the chicken laid the egg, you had to bring the chicken to the rabbi and he would examine it to make sure that the chicken wasn't working on the Sabbath. I'm not making this up. If you were drinking some vinegar with your salad and you had a toothache, you might be practicing medicine on the Sabbath, and on and on and on. So the common people felt like, do I have any hope? If these people are the experts of the law, what is going to happen to me? That's why Galatians 3:10 says, all who rely on observing the law are under a curse, because cursed is anyone who does not do everything in the law. In Matthew 5:20, Jesus said, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Jesus Christ is our righteousness. Jesus Christ is our forgiveness. Jesus Christ is God's provision for sin. Jesus Christ is our burden bearer. Jesus Christ wants to carry what we could not carry ourselves. Galatians 4, verse 4. But when the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive the full rights of sons. Because you are sons, God sent his spirit into our hearts. The spirit calls out, Abba, Father. Verse 7, so you're no longer a slave, but a son. And since you are a son, God has made you an heir. This was such a revolutionary message. And Jesus doesn't point to the religious system. He points to himself. He's the one that takes our burdens, and he's the one that fulfills the law. Many years ago, Pope John Paul II, I believe, made an incredible visit on Christmas morning. Now, I may not believe exactly what the Pope believes, but he did something that was so incarnational, it was incredible. He went to the most despicable prison in Rome. These were men that were hardened criminals, lifetime sentences, many of them facing death in prison or death by execution. And on Christmas morning, he came and served them communion. They were deeply moved. Finally, one man in tears said to the Pope, he said, why did you do this? We are guilty criminals. We don't deserve your coming to us. And he said, I know that you could not come to me, so I came to you. The incarnation, and that wonderful passage we read in Philippians 2, is God saying to you and I at Christmas, I knew that you could not come to me, so I came to you. I'd like to read Ken Geyer's account of the Christmas story, and perhaps we could have the lights down just a little bit, because I'd like you to lean into the creche scene. I would like you to lean into the experience of Mary and Joseph. It was time for the census. The royal family had to travel 85 miles. Joseph walks while Mary, 9 months pregnant, rides side saddle on a donkey, feeling every jolt, every rut, every rock in the road. By the time they arrive the small hamlet of Bethlehem, it's swollen with an influx of travelers. The inn is packed, people feeling lucky if they're able to negotiate a small space on the floor. But now that is even too late. Everyone's asleep and there is no room. But fortunately, the innkeeper is not all shekels and mites. True, his stable is crowded with other guest animals, but if they could squeeze out a little privacy there, they were welcome to it. Joseph looks forlorn and over at Mary, whose attention is concentrated on fighting a contraction. We'll take it, he tells the innkeeper without hesitation. The night is still when Joseph cracks open the stable door, and as he does, a chorus of barn animals make discordant note of the intrusion. The stench is pungent and humid, as there have not been enough hours in the day to tend to the guests, let alone the livestock. A small oil lamp lent them by the innkeeper flickers to the dance of shadows on the walls. A disquieting place for a woman in the throes of childbirth, far from home, far from family, very far from what she expected for her firstborn son. But Mary makes no complaint. It's just a relief to finally get off the donkey. She leans back against the wall, her feet swollen, back aching, contractions growing stronger and more closely together. Joseph's eyes dart around the stable, not a minute to lose. Quickly, a feeding trough will have to make do for a crib. Hay would serve as a mattress. Blankets, his robe, that will do. And those rags hung out to dry, well, a gripping contraction doubles Mary over and sends him racing for a bucket of water. The birth would not be easy, either for the mother or the child. For every royal privilege for this son ended at conception. A scream from Mary knifes through the calm of that silent night, and Joseph returns breathless, water sloshing from the wooden bucket. The top of the baby's head has already pushed its way into the world. Sweat pours from Mary's contorted face as Joseph, the most unlikely midwife in all of Judea, now rushes to her side. The involuntary contractions are not enough, and Mary has to push with all her strength, almost as if God himself were refusing to come into the world without human help. Joseph places a garment beneath her, and with a final push and long sigh in her labors over, the Messiah has arrived. Elongated head from the constricting journey through the birth canal, light skin as the pigment would take even days or weeks to surface. Mucus in his ears and nostrils, wet and slimy and slippery from amniotic fluid. The Son of the Most High God, umbilically tied to a lowly Jewish girl. The baby chokes and coughs. Joseph instinctively turns them over and clears his throat. Then he cries. Mary bares her breast and reaches for the shivering baby. She lays him on her chest, and the helpless cries subside. His tiny head bobs around the unfamiliar terrain. This will be the first thing the infant king learns. Mary can feel his racing heartbeat as he gropes to nurse. Deity, nursing from a young maiden's breast. Could anything be more puzzling or anything be more profound? Joseph sits exhausted, silent, full of wonder. The baby finishes and sighs, the divine word reduced to a few unintelligible sounds. Then for the first time, his eyes fix on his mother's, deity straining to focus, the light of the world is now squinting. Tears pool in Mary's eyes. She touches his tiny hand. And those hands that once sculpted Mount Ranges now cling to her little finger. She looks up at Joseph through a watery veil. Their souls touch. He crowds closer, cheek to cheek, with his betrothed. Together, they stare in awe at the baby Jesus, whose heavy eyelids begin to close. It has been a long journey, but the king is tired, and so, with barely a ripple of notice, God stepped into the warm lake of humanity without protocol and without pretension. Where you would have expected angels, there were only flies. Where you would have expected heads of state, there's only a few donkeys, a few haltered cows, and a nervous group of sheep, a tethered camel, and a furtive scurry of curious barn mice. Except for Joseph, there was no one there to share Mary's pain or her joy. Yes, there were angels announcing the Savior's arrival, but only to a band of blue-collared shepherds, and yes, the magnificent star shone in the sky to mark his birthplace. but only a few foreigners bothered to look up and follow. Thus, in the little town of Bethlehem, that one silent night, the royal birth of God's Son tiptoed quietly by as the world around slept and unnoticed. I'm going to ask you to turn over your bulletin, and maybe we can have the lights for those who do not have special X-ray vision. I'm going to ask the congregation to read the first part of this prayer, starting together. Dear Jesus, read this. On my knees, I confess that I am too conditioned to this world's pomp and pageantry to recognize God cooing in a manger. Now, together, the congregation, forgive me.
And help me understand at least some of what your birth has to teach, that divine power is not an immediate through me.
For those times when you yearn for my fellowship and stand at the door and knock, grant me a special sensitivity to the sound of that knock so that I might be quick to my feet. Keep me from letting you stand out in the cold or from ever sending you away to some stable. May my heart be warming and inviting so that when you do knock, a worthy place will always be waiting.